You're listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wilde. Today, you're going to hear our conversation with journalist and editor Michelle Sisa.
And if you have a lot of housing wealth, then you are wealthy. It's uncomfortable. It's not the same as like a private jet flying billionaire, but it is real wealth and it gives you real power. And we can see that power reflected in what our neighborhoods look like.
My co-host, Paul Kershaw, and I felt very lucky to talk to Michelle because she's written some amazing articles for The Walrus and Maclean's about housing through an intergenerational lens. But we felt particularly lucky about this show because we managed to squeeze in our entire interview while Michelle's baby took a nap. Thank you, baby. Now, I'd also like to mention that this is our 50th episode of Hard Truths. So we want to say thank you for listening, and also, can we ask you a favor? If you're a fan of what we're doing here, would you consider leaving us a review and sharing your favorite episode with someone you think might be interested in the show? Producing a podcast is no small feat for an itty-bitty nonprofit like Generation Squeeze, so spreading the word is a hugely helpful way that you can amplify our work. Thanks. And now for our conversation with Michelle Sisa. All right, well, let's dive in before baby wakes up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you take such a unique perspective on the housing crisis among Canadian journalism, as people are not writing about growing wealth inequality and the housing crisis through an intergenerational lens. So we wonder, why did you personally as a journalist get interested in this perspective?
Well, I have an interesting housing situation that informed my approach. So I grew up on the west side of Vancouver. My parents bought in this neighborhood in the mid-70s when they were early in their careers, and it was affordable for somebody who was like fresh out of university to buy a single family home. So I had the good fortune to grow up in this house, and my parents still own it. They've owned it for 50 years now. And when my husband and I were expecting our first kid, we moved back in with my parents and we sort of renovated the house to be two separate living spaces. And at the time, the contractor we hired said that was, you know, one of the most common kinds of projects he was doing was a lot of these sort of older parents whose adult children were moving back in with them in Vancouver because of the housing market. And so I thought that was really interesting that the stability that I have in the city is really different from most of my friends who don't have these family connections here, who are often in very precarious rental situations, even if they have good jobs and are, you know, objectively speaking, high earners. They don't have that kind of security. And so there is this kind of complication to the generational split in housing where we see that a lot of older Canadians have more housing security, more housing wealth than younger generations. That's true. But there's this funnel of generational wealth that flows to their children, but that's not evenly distributed. That really depends on whether you are lucky to have parents who bought a house in Vancouver or in Toronto or in another, you know, now really expensive market 30 or 40 years ago. So I wanted to talk about that experience in the story because I hadn't seen it discussed. And I also wanted to talk about it from this kind of position of what we owe our community members, because I will inherit a lot of housing wealth from my parents that I didn't earn. And I'm really grateful for that. But I think there's an obligation that comes with that good fortune to think, how do we create a society that's fairer? What are my obligations to the people in my community who work just as hard as me, who have roots in this community that are just as deep, you know, who care about their lives here, who have kids here and jobs and reasons to stay, and through no fault of their own, not as a result of a lack of hard work or a lack of effort, may be forced to leave. So I was interested in that idea of community building and considering how we solve the housing crisis from that approach.
And I definitely want to get back to some of those things, but I want to quote UDU first. Your article from The Walrus in the fall, there was a wonderful line that just painted such an excellent picture of how housing has changed class dynamics. So here's the quote. In this system, the security of renters is secondary to the financial interests of owners. But listening to the laments of the Airbnb class, it's clear there's an identity crisis playing out among property owners who do not understand or refuse to accept that their assets confer upon them a status that makes Canadians squirm rich. So few people talk about housing that way, and we struggle with this daily. How do we help Canadians resolve this identity crisis and see that wealth? Do you have any ideas, having written about this?
I think this is one of the hardest challenges to deal with. And partly it comes out of how we talk about the housing crisis as something that's controlled by these factors that are bigger than us, you know, developer interests, government policy, where there's this kind of idea that individual homeowners are not having any kind of impact. And so the housing crisis is bad, but it's nothing to do with their attitudes or their beliefs. And to a degree, I think that's not true. Like, we can see in our cities how many neighborhoods have remained largely unchanged and as a result, incredibly unaffordable to young families. And that's in some ways the product of people resisting change and trying to keep their neighborhood, their street exactly as it was when they bought it. And they don't see this as an elite activity. They don't see it as exclusionary. They see themselves as probably who they were when they bought the house, when they probably were closer to the middle class, especially if it was 30 or 40 years ago. And they don't see their house's value as real, I think. So even if tomorrow they could list their house for sale and make $3 or $4 million, which is the case in most of the west side of Vancouver, they don't think that money counts. And so when they resist something like a new apartment building or a condo development, they're working from this place of thinking that they're protecting this very average lifestyle, this very normal way of living. And that's really not true anymore. Like, there's no major city in Canada where that kind of, you know, access to a single family house is as affordable and as accessible to young people as it was a generation ago. And I'm just very interested in the way condo developments in particular are often positioned as luxury condos. They're like for this sort of shadowy rich person who's coming in and they're going to change this like normal middle class neighborhood into an elite enclave. But a condo is far cheaper than a single family house. And the people who are buying that condo are probably doing so because they have no way to access the wealth that would be required to buy the single family house that this person is living in who objects to the condo development. Like, there's this real kind of cognitive dissonance about wealth and assets and what those mean. And I think that's such a key illusion that has to be dismantled, that people need to recognize the power and the position that they have through their housing. Housing is the main form of wealth in Canada that most people draw on. And if you have a lot of housing wealth, then you are wealthy. It's uncomfortable. It's not the same as, you know, being Galen Weston or like a private jet flying billionaire, but it is real wealth and it gives you real power. And we can see that power reflected in what our neighborhoods look like.
There's so much to unpack there, to nod with. You know, as I've been listening to Michelle, a new insight came to me. And I wonder, in some regard, an older demographic is, you know, I'm going to turn 50. People my age and older, been in the housing market for decades. We're kind of resisting the idea that actually we should have to contribute more taxes on the wealth that we've accumulated. So I'm like, is it really real wealth? It's just on paper. But then people resist a little bit. I don't really want my value of my home to go down. So is it really just wealth on paper? But I think actually, to some degree, the relative privilege of the homeowner today, especially the single detached homeowner, so it's not that they've necessarily, in their living experiences, really improved, though their wealth has. But what's so changed is actually for those who follow in their footsteps, the ability to live like them is no longer in reach. And so it's the loss for those who follow that is then, by relative standards, making those who came in earlier affluent. And I wonder if it's harder for people to come to terms with being relatively affluent as opposed to their experiencing that they've somehow gained something. As I think that aloud, what does that make sense to you? How have you engaged with that theme?
I think it's just impossible for anyone to conceive of themselves as wealthy if they see someone else who has more. And like you say, their circumstances haven't changed. You know, they're living in the same house that they've been in for decades. They don't see it as fancy. They're not taking lavish vacations maybe every year, especially from people who also maybe have a secondary suite that they rent out. There's often these laments about like the cost and upkeep required that goes into that and the headaches of dealing with renters. And so they don't see it as a privilege. They see it as a kind of burden. And there's this idea that the house has no real value because they live in it. They can't access that wealth, which I think is an interesting myth that other people have pointed out is not exactly true. You know, you can get a reverse mortgage. You can use the value of your house to acquire more properties that you can rent out, which is also increasingly common that we have this class of investor owners in Canada. But I think it just doesn't feel tangible to people. And what they see often is younger people who live differently than they do, and they see that as kind of reckless spending. So, you know, if someone doesn't have a house, but they are going to Mexico on vacation, or if they have like a nice car, that's just young people spending their money differently. And that's why they can't afford to buy this house. They're looking at lifestyle choices, or like the indefeatable idea that young people are spending too much on restaurants and too much on coffee. And I think it's just, you know, this failure to grasp the magnitude of difference between somebody who buys a latte every day and someone who has, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars required for a down payment and the massive income required to pay a mortgage on a home in Vancouver. It's just, I think, a very distorted view of that reality. So I think we look for these markers of wealth, you know, maybe their behaviors. And that's hard to reconcile because I think that is different. That probably has changed. My parents talk about how, you know, when they were younger, they didn't go out to restaurants much and the pace of consumption was very different. But I don't think that closes the gap, you know, the amount of coffees you would have to sacrifice to.
Oh, we've calculated that. Yeah. We're the groups doing the latte calculations. And in many a city, you'd have to be drinking 17 lattes a day, every day of the year for 5 to 6 years in order to, you know, make up for, you know, saving that 20% down payment. If no one's doing that, you're vomiting latte at that level.
It's this compounding unaffordability too, right? Like younger people are graduating with more student debt. They don't have the ability to save that our parents did. They are spending all their money on rent and student loans often. And I think there is a real nihilism among a lot of people that they've just given up on this idea. Like they've crunched the numbers, they've looked at how long they would have to save to ever afford a down payment, and they just believe it's not in the cards for them. And so like, why not put that $30 towards a dinner out if you're never going to afford a down payment anyway? And I think that's kind of an unreasonable side of the debate, that it makes it into an individual problem, right? It's saying that people's individual behaviors are the problem as opposed to this massive system of inequality.
Yeah. And I don't want to belabor the individual level because we're a group that likes to bring people up to the systemic level. But we've been hearing younger folks for over a decade say, you know, the more and more that the expectations of being able to have secure housing, you know, is getting out of reach for me, whether as an owner or even now as a renter, then use the language of nihilism. Others like it's a coping mechanism. It's kind of grieving over it. It's just like, what's the point? And so, yeah, I am going to some degree use whatever spare cash I have right now, which isn't ever going to get me into secure housing, for that short-term pleasure. But let's bring it back up to the people who actually have the unearned windfall, the privilege, the power coming out of this. And they're more often, in many instances, like resisting acknowledging it. So I'm delighted at Gen Squeeze. We increasingly have a group of what I like to call older generational fairness mavens who recognize their relative privilege. But in other instances, we still manage to run into folks who are remarkably defensive. And I imagine with the kinds of articles that you've been writing in McLean's and in The Walrus, and you're also experiencing people being defensive. So I wonder if you might do two things for us. Share some of your experiences of maybe the most outrageous examples of defensiveness. And also, what do you do to diffuse that defense in a constructive way? And how can a group like Jan Squeeze learn from your tactics?
I love the first part of this because I find the responses sometimes very fascinating, and they can be very funny. So one example is Twitter, or X as we should call it now, is a really interesting place to gauge reactions to topics. And when I posted something about how people who, you know, own $2 million houses are wealthy in a very objective sense, I got a really fascinating cross-section of responses. And I think my favorite theme in there was people saying, so you think we should force seniors to sell their beloved homes and be homeless? And also a subset of that was saying, you know, if my beloved grandmother sells her $4 million house, where is she supposed to live? There's nothing else for her out there. So there's a couple things in there that I think are really interesting. One is that there's, you know, this vast difference between forcing people to sell their homes, which no one is talking about, and maybe making it less profitable for them to hoard that wealth indefinitely. Because I have heard from people in older generations saying that they want to downsize, but they feel like they have to stay in this house because it's the main source of inheritance for their children. And there's a lot of seniors who are overhoused in Vancouver, and they're not staying in that house necessarily because they have so many positive memories and because they love it so much, but because it's like a big pile of gold that gets bigger and bigger every year. And the other one is that people are afraid that if their, you know, beloved grandparents sell their houses, that someday they'll find themselves destitute and homeless. And I think that really speaks to the anxiety about how precarious the situation is for renters, particularly renters who are seniors, which is a significant proportion of seniors. I think it's a quarter of all seniors in Canada are renters.
20%, yeah.
And they're in this tremendously vulnerable position where if they lose their housing and they're on a fixed income and they're past, you know, the age where they can work, they have nowhere to go. And many of them have been renting in the same place for a very long time. So they're paying below market rents. They cannot afford market rents. And there's a real sidelining of those seniors in these discussions when we focus on seniors who are abundantly housed, who have a tremendous amount of housing wealth, where a lot of policies and a lot of cultural conversations seem pointed towards how we protect their assets and allow them to continue to grow their assets for the benefit of their children and grandchildren. As opposed to thinking, you know, what about this population of seniors that is incredibly vulnerable? And you can see that when you see that people don't want their grandmother to be a renter because they can sense the vulnerability in that. So I think that's the interesting one, this idea that if we create fair policies, somehow we'll be forcing all of these sweet grannies into the street, which nobody is trying to do. We're just thinking about fair measures of taxation. And what was the second part of your question? I got so into the...
Well, let's just linger here. And then the second part is, how do you sort of diffuse some of the defensiveness that you experience? But you're sharing some insights that I didn't expect you to share. So I'd love to just push on it a bit further. First off, some of the defensiveness that you're reporting is actually being articulated by younger people. And I love you use the language of beloved. We use the language of beloved a lot of the time to try and remind people. A younger demographic loves those who are older than us, just as those older folks love those who are following their footsteps. So I love your use of beloved. But you're actually reminding us that there's a younger demographic that's worried about protecting their older loved ones, even when those older ones actually are enjoying quite a lot of affluence. And I think that just highlighting that kind of defensiveness is probably useful for promoting the intergenerational solidarity we ultimately need our public policy to reflect and promote. I think, as Jen Squeeze is probably the front face for conversations about taxing housing wealth more in Canada, we have designed our policy recommendations so that if you are the little old lady grandmother who has, you know, millions in wealth but not a lot of cash on, in an income basis on an annual basis, that we design the policy so that you just defer paying any additional taxes until the home is sold or inherited. So that makes it easy and protects people from that risk of having to move out. So I want to ask you, don't you find it interesting that even as we're trying to observe that a younger demographic is disproportionately being harmed by a housing system that's locking them out of home ownership, increasingly making it more challenging to rent, when you talk about asking those who have benefited to contribute more, like, but wait, those are people I love too. I don't know if that's appropriate. What do you make of that?
I think there's this persistent theme of deservingness that runs through housing. So when you talk about housing wealth, a lot of people say, well, they've earned that. Like, they worked hard their whole lives. It's not their fault that their house is worth so much. So why should they be taxed when, like, that's the market, that's not them? Which, again, I think is an interesting one, because you say, like, okay, well, if the value of their house is so abstract, like, would you be happy if it dropped by 50%? Most people don't want their house to lose value, but they also don't want to pay taxes commensurate with that value. And they believe that they've earned it, you know, that they deserve it, that their children deserve it, but also that it's not their fault that they've become rich. So there's this tension that's really hard to untangle. It's very thorny. And it, I think, has to do with the fact that nobody wants to feel like a sinister rich person who's in some small way contributing to the suffering of others by hoarding wealth. Nobody wants to be that person. And so there's, I think, a very strong self-protective instinct to deflect there and to defend our our parents and our grandparents from feeling implicated in the moral questions about housing, which is, you know, how does protecting your assets, your home, your neighborhood, your street, how does that harm other people? Because it does. We can see that it does when there's nowhere to live in Vancouver that's affordable because 3/4 of the land has effectively been sequestered for single family homes, which are not affordable. That is quite a tough nut to crack. And the way I've tried to approach it is to show people that we are starting to see the impacts and connect those dots of the fact that their kids' school has no teachers, that there are healthcare positions that are critical that are unfilled because healthcare workers can't afford to live here. We see in these really wealthy neighborhoods in Vancouver, like Dunbar and West Point Grey, that they're becoming ghost towns, you know, because the population is falling, because younger people can't afford to move in, and existing residents are often empty nesters now. Businesses are closing. There's a real lack of vibrancy that people can see, and they don't like it. They want their kids to be able to live closer to them. They want their local businesses to survive. They want to live in thriving neighborhoods. I think it's just helping them understand that that does require change, that the houses on their street that sit empty are not going to be filled by young families because those young families can't afford them. And I think trying to appeal to that empathy that I think people really do have. I think the vast majority of older people I know are incredibly sympathetic to the plight of young people who are dealing with this unaffordability, who can't afford to have kids, who are being forced to leave their communities. They are sympathetic to that. It's just helping them understand that they do have the power to change that, that they can help to shape policies and make the city maybe more inclusive, that it's not totally out of their hands. And that when they do something like protest an apartment down the street because they're afraid of what it's going to do to parking or because they don't like the aesthetics, which is like such a common reason for objecting, those protests, those erosions bit by bit, are transforming their community into one that's less hospitable and less livable.
I'm going to jump in because that's one thing I've really enjoyed about some of your articles is how you so eloquently and poignantly explain what's at stake. It's more than just shelter. It's these big picture changes in society. And I wonder if you could tell us more about that. Like, what have you seen at stake from the neighborhoods out to political polarization and some of these bigger consequences?
Yeah, I mean, to paint a picture of the neighborhood I live in, which I love, it's a great neighborhood. And I think it's been insulated from some of the depleting effects of unaffordability because it has a lot of low-rise buildings and high-rise buildings that were built in the 90s and also older co-ops that were built in the 70s. It has a lot of mixed-use housing around the core of the village. So as a neighborhood, I think it's great. But one thing I don't see often is young families. And I don't know a lot of other people with young children in this neighborhood. When I was a kid, I feel like every house on my street had kids that I could play with. And that's really changed. And I see that change when I take my daughter to the playground. And our local community center playground is often empty. And then when I go across town and visit friends who live in Mount Pleasant or in sort of the central neighborhoods of the city where there's more apartments, more rentals, those neighborhoods, like their playgrounds are packed. It's like Kid City over there. And that's, you know, one of the places that's most visible, for instance, is in the huge wait list for elementary schools in schools in the core of the city versus on the west side where I am, where a lot of schools are really under-enrolled now just because there's no kids living near them. And what I see in my friends is just this real tenuous grasp on their life here. You know, they have well-established careers, they have kids in school, and yet they're living in a rental that they know if they were to have to leave, that would be it. Like, they can't afford a similar apartment at market rates. They don't have family support here necessarily. And that would mean starting their entire life over somewhere else. And I think that's a terrifying position for people to be in, to be living, hanging from this thread of like a single landlord or a single rental, to have your entire life balanced on that, and really be unable to change that circumstance because you can't afford a down payment for something more stable. And we often hear that people should just pick up and move somewhere cheaper, which I think is kind of crazy advice when you consider like what's involved in moving to a new community. You know, having to find new daycares for your children, which is an impossible task anywhere, having to put them in new schools, starting your career over, that's a huge undertaking. Moving itself is incredibly expensive. And so that's, I don't think, a very practical solution. But for people who do it, it's also just really heartbreaking. Like, they're leaving their entire lives. And I've seen people who've had to leave the city who are just devastated by it. And the idea that, you know, you can work hard, you can make all the right decisions, you can save, you can put down roots, and that adds up to this incredible precarity, I think, is like a big failure of our society. People shouldn't have to make every single perfect choice to deserve to live somewhere. But when the people who are doing that are still in this position of being forced out, often the prime of their careers, you know, where they are making these very valuable contributions to our community as teachers, as healthcare workers, as ambulance drivers, as the people who keep our restaurants and libraries and all the other essential services we rely on staffed, when those people are leaving, it's bad for them, it's bad for our communities, and it just demonstrates that our society has really failed to fulfill its promises to its citizens.
I feel like a bobblehead because I'm here just nodding so much. I so understand. And I, yes, having packed up my life and moved to Vancouver, and I think the moment that it always gets to me most is whenever I'm filling out a form for my kids, like, give the name of two people who can pick up your kid. I've been here almost 3 years. I finally have two names to put there. I'm not going to give that up. I'm going to go somewhere else where I have no one else who could pick up my kids in an emergency.
Yeah.
One thing in your articles about the pandemic showing just how flawed that solution is of just moving somewhere else more affordable and
Yes. The
mass scale of unaffordability spreading. I wonder if you could talk more about that, just how that solution in particular is kind of bogus.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that like pick up and move somewhere else, it's advice that might work on an individual case-by-case basis for some people. Like, there are certainly people who've moved from Vancouver to Edmonton and experienced a real increase in quality of life because they can afford a home, and that's great for them. But an interesting thing that happened during the pandemic was you saw some people who were able to save more money because they had reduced all these costs due to the pandemic. They were still earning their full salary because they were working from home, but they weren't going out. They weren't commuting and spending money on gas. And they had a lot of mobility suddenly because their jobs had become remote. So they didn't need to stay in Vancouver or in Toronto. They could go anywhere. And there was a really unprecedented wave of people leaving, especially in Ontario, leaving Ontario for cheaper provinces. That's where it was the most dramatic. And all of a sudden you had communities, particularly in the Maritimes, that experienced like a huge increase in population, where these communities that were not designed to welcome a huge influx of new residents suddenly saw the same pressures on their housing markets that we've seen in Vancouver and Toronto for years. So not enough supply, skyrocketing costs, and pressures particularly displaced onto the most vulnerable residents. So renters and young people who were suddenly scrabbling for a foothold in a city that had welcomed people with a much higher level of income and wealth because they were coming from Toronto or Hamilton. And in BC, we've seen similar phenomenon where people leave Vancouver for the Sunshine Coast or for Vancouver Island or for communities in the interior like Nelson. And those communities, too, have seen their housing markets go crazy, and they've seen the pressures that come from that. So, you know, I have friends in Nelson who can't get a family doctor, or they can't find a childcare space, or their schools are full. You can't just dump a bunch of people in a cheaper community when there's no infrastructure to support them and there's not enough housing. And so right now, for instance, Saskatoon is a fairly affordable Canadian city. But if everybody who's priced out of Vancouver moved to Saskatoon, they would have the same problems we are having in Vancouver. You can't just tell people to chase a cheaper standard of living because it doesn't work. It just moves the problem around. And we've seen that since the pandemic in the way so many more housing markets have become insanely unaffordable in a really short period of time. It doesn't take a lot to totally confound the local economics of housing supply and demand, especially in these smaller cities. So I think that's the strongest refutation of this idea that we can just sort of distribute people evenly to solve the crisis. It doesn't work in small towns. It doesn't work in medium-sized cities. It doesn't work anywhere.
Yeah, I think you've just brought to life why we've long said that during the pandemic, in many respects, we spread the virus of housing unaffordability as rapidly, if not more rapidly, than we spread the virus of COVID. And as we're kind of nearing the end of our time, I wanted to go back to a word that you use, empathy. I think you rightly characterize that so many of the older family members in our lives are in the camp of people who are remarkably empathetic about the challenges being faced by the kids, their grandchildren, or the grandchildren they'd like to have if they don't yet have them, partly because of the unaffordability pressures. And that word that you use, empathy, really resonates with me because more and more I have this opportunity to write relatively regularly for the Globe and Mail. And in my most recent columns, I find myself saying, I thought I was writing for the business section, but I didn't think that my primary recommendation as a solution was just be kind.
Yeah.
Like, recognize your relative privilege, don't be an ass about it, and be kind to those who aren't enjoying the same relative privilege that you are. And I wonder, what's your experience in acknowledging people's empathy and showing how that they just communicate that empathy in their circles or even publicly as citizens, that that can be such a big part of the changing of our system, of creating political cover for our politicians to respond to the challenges facing younger folks and newcomers of any age and to disrupt the status quo? Tell us about how you preach empathy.
The responsibility that I feel as a writer and a journalist is to question some of the narratives that we hear so often that we just accept them as truth. And often what that looks like in housing is positioning so much political messaging and public messaging towards this class of homeowners and older homeowners, right? So in Vancouver, our mayor was describing this like terrible, unfair, unreasonable property tax increase of 9%, which given Vancouver's incredibly low property tax rate was a couple hundred dollars extra a year for most homeowners and far less than what renters are facing annually with maximum allowable rent increases under our Tenancy Act. But we just don't hear about them. Like, that's not something that comes up often. They're not centered in these discussions of housing. And so when you're talked to all the time as the kind of protagonist in this housing debate and as the person who all of these relief measures should coalesce around, I think it's easy to think of yourself that way, that you're a deserving homeowner, that increases of taxes are unfair, that your financial situation is harder than other people's. And so I think a key responsibility is to bring forward narratives and perspectives that are often left out of this. So reminding people of the existence of renters, of the decisions that young people are having to make about their futures, just complicating that narrative a little bit for people and maybe making them think about a perspective that they haven't seen represented. And we should be pushing politicians to do a better job of that, because I think young people have also been really failed by political leaders who totally ignore their realities when they make promises about making unaffordable housing more affordable to them, because making housing affordable for more people will require diminishing the wealth or the wealth accumulating potential of other people. Like, we can't have both all the time indefinitely. So I think it's understanding how to acknowledge those realities and ask people, you know, what's important to you? Is it that your house becomes more and more valuable to this astronomical degree where you can someday hope that your children inherit a $5 million property? Or is it that those children who inherit the property have a community to live in that's sustainable, that their kids can go to school in the neighborhood, that they have places to work, that they have colleagues? Like, do you want a community or do you want a wealthy descendant in isolation? I think most people do care about the community. They just don't see that perspective, that kind of collective interest discussed as much. It's often in these really abstract economic terms, which don't have as much emotional resonance for people.
One of my favorite lines from your writing of late is the observation that the 9% tax increase in Vancouver results in about $250-$300 in additional taxation. And your observation was, you know, you could save that amount of money by drinking one less cup of coffee a day. So it's not going to help the young person actually save for a home or pay her rent, but it would help you on that front, you know, the slight increase in taxes.
Well, another example I really want to mention is when people oppose new housing, they're often complaining about street parking.
Okay.
This comes up all the time in Vancouver. And, you know, my husband and I have a car. I get it. But I am parking my private property on a public street. And people just assume, because it's a very normalized thing, that you own the space in front of your house and that other people encroach on that when they also have vehicles to put somewhere. And to me, that's an example of this sort of established, like, cultural norm that we don't even think to question, that we think somebody else's ability to have a home, that need for housing, is less important than where we store our personal property on public land, our unquestioned right to have that. And, you know, I don't want to attack people unfairly. I don't think that people are being sort of deliberately selfish or obtuse. I just think we don't really talk enough about collective consequences of this entitlement. And we should. We should just make them visible. We should calculate all the costs. We should tally them up.
You know, you talk more boldly and bravely about the issue of taxes than many a journalist and many a commentator. You talk about, you know, collective impact. We are kindred spirits here on this call today doing that. When we do it at Gen Squeeze, we often have people charge, I think, in an intellectually weak way, oh, you're just so communist. It's just such a throwaway comment that, you know, they're trying to end conversation that's somehow inconsistent to think about, you know, collective impact or taxation in a capitalist society. Do you get that kind of BS retort, and how do you manage it?
I mean, I get that all the time. I think it's really interesting that people seem to think capitalism is like things that are good for me as an individual and socialism are things that are bad for me as an individual, because we live in a society that has many socialist frameworks that I think a lot of people appreciate, like a public education system, roads that you can drive your Tesla down. We appreciate that. And housing is this interesting phenomenon where it is subsidized. It is in some ways like this system where the government has made it possible for people to have this housing wealth. They are receiving the benefits of these socialized programs. Our housing market has been set up to really benefit and subsidize the interests of owners over renters. But, you know, the bigger picture problem is, I think, this real divisiveness where we characterize positions that we disagree with or that challenge us as sort of this flawed view of our political opponents. I don't know that that's very helpful for society. I think it's been enormously helpful for politicians. And so I do try and question it when I see it. Like, I often wonder what people are even talking about when they use the word communist, but I personally am not offended by it. So I'm happy to be called a commie.
Yes. So I think I want to ask, because you live in a house above your mom, have you had these conversations with her? How does that go? And especially living in your childhood neighborhood, surely you know some older neighbors. How do those conversations go?
I have this conversation with my parents a lot. And I think we've struggled through these talking points because I think, again, they did work very hard their entire careers. They made really good choices to save and, you know, to stay in this house and like ensure that their children would be well set up as adults. And so I think that they also are thinking through what that means for the community. Like, they see the same sort of talking points about luxury condos and they worry about that. But I think knowing more younger people, knowing me and my friends and seeing the struggles, you know, having these conversations with my mom about why my friends aren't having more kids or why I'm one of three children and why I don't have any friends who think they'll be able to afford to have three children. Like, I think that does help them understand the stakes and what's really different, because it is such a huge change across generations, you know, from their time of being able to like save for their university education with a summer job and then get a stable career right out of university without debt and then buy a house. They didn't come from wealthy families at all. And they both came from really working class backgrounds, and they worked hard and they were rewarded for that. And I think it's really hard to wrap your head around the fact that that just is not a path that's available to people anymore, you know, and that it doesn't say anything negative about them, but it does require them to just grapple with the changing reality and not expect that other people who are younger can just follow the path they did and have the same result. So I found it really helpful to talk to my parents. They're thoughtful and empathetic people, and they are also coming at it from a really different generational standpoint. So I think it helps us to like understand each other better. And I hope it makes me a better journalist for talking about generational tensions.
I think that's a brilliant summary. one of your many wonderful insights that you've shared today. But I think what the big challenge before us is, how do you ask those for whom hard work paid off better in the past to now contribute towards solutions in recognition that, you know, the economy is not rewarding hard work in the way that it used to? So I think you're doing an excellent job in helping us really just hone our attention on the cultural shift that we need to make in our heads and hearts in order to create the policy changes that will ultimately get to the root problem in
the dream.
The dream, exactly.
And our timing is so perfect. Just waking up.
Oh, you gotta be okay. Good timing.
Perfect timing. Yeah.
Tell him thank you.
I will. Thank you for having me on. This has been really fun.
Wonderful.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll be sure to post links to Michelle's work in the show notes and on our website, jensqueeze.ca.